The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Hello and welcome to Stephanomics, the podcast that brings the global economy to you. This week we're thinking about jobs, machines and COVID-19. At the start of this pandemic, a lot of people decided globalization was dead. Companies would pull their factories out of China and supply chains would shrink. By and large, companies haven't done that, but COVID-19 does seem to have brought forward the day when an awful lot of the jobs we see around us are done by a machine. In a few minutes, I'll be talking about what the future holds with Harvard Economics Chair and deep thinker about all things labour-related, Richard Freeman. Our Chief European Economist, Jamie Rush, is also going to explain why the answer to the biggest question in the global economy right now is $3.2 trillion. I'll leave you to work out what the question is. But first, here's US economy reporter Olivia Rockman on the truth about robots and jobs in the year of COVID-19.
Adding more robots to factories, retail stores, or mines was historically seen as a job killer by workers and the unions that support them. But this year, automation has allowed sectors of the economy to continue producing with fewer people, or without any at all, minimizing the coronavirus risk for workers. Unions have recognized that automation will continue to accelerate to avoid massive outbreaks like the ones seen in U.S. meatpacking plants earlier this year. But while they're all for protecting workers, their concern is widespread and permanent job loss. In many cases, once a company invests the cash to implement automation, it's unlikely that they'll take their workers back. A highway in Pennsylvania cut 500 toll worker jobs earlier this year after putting an electronic system into place, and it doesn't plan to bring any of the employees back. Marcus Casey, an economist at the University of Illinois at Chicago, spoke with me about how eliminating jobs can exacerbate inequality if those workers aren't taught new skills.
High-skilled jobs that require a creative or human touch, so to speak, will remain, even in cases where pay is not necessarily much higher. For example, skilled workers, say professors like myself, may see our pay as relatively flat in the future. However, among people who aren't necessarily as skilled, because there'll be fewer jobs, you might see pay actually decrease because of increased competition in those sectors.
One solution to the inequality problem is increased investment in reskilling, which can help factory workers transition into jobs in healthcare, for example, where automation is more difficult to implement. That's U.S. President-elect Joe Biden's plan: ensure that employers give workers impacted by automation advance notice and put them at the front of the line for new jobs, as well as paid skills training. Currently, though, the United States, Chile, and Mexico spend the least among OECD countries on policies intended to improve job readiness and expand employment. That isn't likely to change quickly because health concerns are coming first, and Casey says there will be consequences.
We already have a long-term problem with people who are prime age and not working. Our employment to population ratio has been declining for many decades. And suppose in the future we go from a situation where we have a 67 or 68% employment to population rate to maybe a 50% employment to population rate. many of those people are young prime age males, and our social insurance programs tend to direct money away from that population.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
So I'm delighted now to be able to talk to Richard Freeman, Herbert Asherman Chair of Economics at Harvard, taught me a lot about labour markets quite a long time ago. Richard, thanks for coming on Stephanomics. We're talking this week about the impact that COVID-19 has had on workers in the US and Europe, and also how 2020 fits into the longer term structural changes in the labour market that you've spent a lot of your life thinking about and studying. And one thing that's come up a lot is the unequal way that this pandemic has hit societies and households, with poorer people much more likely to get sick and more likely to lose their jobs. But we also know that fiscal stimulus, certainly in the US, actually increased the disposable income of many lower wage Americans in 2020. And I think you've also had many parts of the world a kind of outbreak of social solidarity in many places, and maybe a new appreciation of the value of people in some of these low paid jobs that we were reminded are so important for keeping the country going. So when you look back at 2020, do you think it's going to mark a break with some of those long term trends for labor, or more an acceleration?
My guess is it will more accelerate things, because the good outcomes that we had particularly through our almost unanimous CARES Act that really provided the people who lost their jobs and the low income people at least financial protection. That was a one-time thing. We may in the next few days pass something else, but that'll also be a short-term policy. The longer-term thing is that we've created two different kinds of workers. Those who work at home using computer technologies, and those who work interacting with other humans in dangerous settings. And so I think the real push is going to be to automate more of those jobs, and to do more work at home phenomenon. And that benefits one group of people, managers, professionals, and that harms another group of people. The people we were told X years ago, not so long ago, were going to be the heart of the new economy. It wasn't going to be, guys working in big factories. It was going to be all the people who interact with other humans. If this COVID is a one-off and we don't see another one in another 5-6 years, maybe we'll just go back to a more normal phenomenon. But there's certainly a chunk of thinking in the scientific community that this is just the first pandemic that we're going to see. And there are more coming down the line. We're entering an age of pandemics. That this is not the first one that's going to jump. And the climate change is going to add more to this. So if this is a turning point, it's going to be a turning point changing work, and I think speeding up automation and creating more problems for the lower skill people.
Just to dig into that a bit, because there obviously is quite a lot of debate, and it predates COVID, about the impact that the next wave of automation and artificial intelligence could have on inequality and on jobs. And there is an argument that says actually this next wave is going to be kind of different, and that the jobs that we see being replaced are kind of accountants, quite high skill workers that have done well in the previous few decades, the middle manager types potentially. And you might argue, I mean, if we don't live permanently in pandemic, you know, those kind of person to job jobs, hairdressing, all those things, I mean, they didn't go away in the pandemic, and we're all trying to go back to our hairdressers when we can. So I wonder whether you're exaggerating the impact of COVID and not seeing potentially the other side of this automation, which does seem to have accelerated.
Yeah, I've been sympathetic to the view that the more skilled people would be replaceable by really smart AI. But so far, the evidence is that hasn't happened. And all the AI experts told us accounting is going to just die off. And in fact, the accountants keep increasing. And of course, the accountant profession gets more computerized and people learn more skills. Yeah, it's hard for me to now see that those are the people who are going to be threatened, as opposed to the clerks in the stores. And if we want to go to a store, I suppose I'd rather see a robot. It's safer for me as a consumer to deal with a robot that can't carry the disease.
There is an odd challenge that, on the one hand, we talk a lot about the risk of automation and the likelihood that automation is going to take jobs, at least in a chunk of the workforce. And yet we have this ongoing problem of very low labor productivity relative to the past. So what's the answer to that? Because on the face of it, it does seem a conundrum that automation could be destroying jobs, but somehow not increasing our productivity, the amount that we can make per person.
Yeah, well, some of that has to do with the sectors. I mean, almost the vast bulk of the first automation things have been factories. And productivity there has done reasonably well. So it's been in the service sectors where it's been slower, and that's where the workforce has shifted to. If we begin to see more automation in the service sectors, we will see productivity go up, and there'll be job problems.
The wages would go up in some of these service sector jobs. The few that are left would get higher wages. So at least we will have wage growth even if we've lost the jobs.
No, correct. So I don't think if we have a reasonably well-organized economy that we're going to see mass unemployment, these things, 80 million, 100 million jobs disappearing, and depending on which country they're or which area of the world they're talking about. I mean, what should happen is the workers will find some other jobs, and that will put downward pressure in those labor markets. And I think the actual, our concern should be much more, what is automation going to do to the structure of wages? And that gets back to your earlier thing. Is it going to harm the wages of the accountants and the managers, or is it going to harm the wages of the clerks and the your restaurant that has no waiters or waitresses, but just buttons? I've been in one in China where you just push buttons. I assume there must be more in Japan. And okay, then there's, you feel safer. Et cetera. And it's more, maybe it's more efficient, et cetera, as well. And if that's going to be the way of the world, then where are the people who would have held those jobs going to go? We have to worry about them. I think, I would not trust natural forces, aging or automation, to take care of the poorer and less skilled people. I think that's something we as societies have to deal with.
So one point you made over the years, which I think is probably much more accepted now than when you were first teaching me about it in the mid-90s, is the power of institutional change and the institutions, rules, social mores, and how they have affected what happens to workers in the labor market, what happens to wages, you know, that it's not just these aren't unstoppable forces that we can do nothing to control. We have a new administration in the US.
Yes.
Given what you know, what could the Biden administration do to improve the outcomes for labor in the next few years?
I'll take three things. One, Biden is incredibly committed to trade union reforms. So he has, I've never seen a president speak so strongly. And sometimes it seems like a voice from the past. He goes back.
He is sometimes a voice from the past.
That is
correct. He was around in the past too. We know that.
That is correct. So he said, gee, FDR said that America could encourage unions, and that's what I'm going to do. So there is a pretty well set out plan. I don't know if they can get it through the Congress that would indeed strengthen that, but they're certainly going to try. The second area that I think they will move is in the occupational health and safety area, the OSHA, which should have stepped forward in the pandemic as a major force, making sure workers are protected. In the US, the current debate is where the Republicans want to give employers who bring workers back to unsafe workplaces protection against legal suits for you brought me back to an unsafe workplace. And that's insane in some level. And it'll just cause more disaster for everybody. And so I think there'll be a big push on the OSHA, and we should be doing obviously more R&D on how can we protect workers in workplaces. That would be a more natural thing to do. The third area that they will push is something with training people for the new technologies. And so there's a big move inside the parts of the US government that they need really major changes in training. And I think the administration will love this when they see what is being planned. So there'll be those fronts, but there have to be major tax changes as well. And how the Biden administration will be able to reduce the tax cuts given to the billionaires and their friends, and do something more for ordinary citizens, we'll see.
Richard Freeman, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Now, what value would you put on the ability to lead a normal life? Well, you might say it's priceless, but Bloomberg economists say it's $3 trillion. That's the net benefit to the global economy of countries with vaccination programs for COVID-19 being able to get back to normal in 2021. Now, that analysis was carried out by Chief EMEA Economist Jamie Rush, our Chief Asia Economist Chang Shu, and Senior Global Economist Bjorn Van Roy. And Jamie Rush is with me now. Jamie, briefly, how did you come up with this number, just over $3 trillion?
So we thought of it as a bounding exercise. We asked ourselves, you know, what's the best that might be possible for these economies if everything just happens to go just right? And so the way we approached it is we divided the world into three groups of countries. We thought that there are some that have got a chance, perhaps, of achieving herd immunity, some that would only be able to vaccinate the vulnerable populations, and some who probably even struggle to do that. So it's that first group of countries that has the best chance of getting back to normal. There'll still be cases in those countries, but widespread transmission is pretty unlikely. That means very low fatalities, very low personal and societal risk. So it's these countries which have a good chance of getting back to normal. So what we did to work out if the countries in this group is we just compared the number of doses that are on order with the size of the population. And we found that about 16 major economies are able to do that, and they're accounting for about half of world GDP and a third of the population. So we're thinking, what's the best that's possible for them? Well, maybe they can get back to their pre-crisis trend, just maybe. So we estimate that in 4Q, and taking into account the impact of fresh lockdowns...
The last three months of this year.
That's right, yeah. So the last 3 months, we were looking at those. And we think that on average, those 16 economies are about 6% below their pre-crisis trend level of output. So if you're able to vaccinate a very substantial proportion of the population in those countries, then maybe if everything goes right, you could get back to that trend level. So 6% increase in GDP, which is about 3.2% of world GDP. In that second group, with countries that are just able to vaccinate the vulnerable populations, we think there are about 11 major economies, and these are mostly emerging market economies, and they don't make up a huge amount of world GDP. But we think that vaccinating the vulnerable could have a very big impact on the economy, because if you think of it, it will very significantly reduce fatalities. So intensive care beds won't be overburdened. The risk of death for most people will be very low. And so you should still see a very meaningful boost in GDP. But because these economies that are in this group are a bit smaller, you only add an extra 0.5% to world GDP. And so it's those two groups that account for the $3 trillion boost.
I mean, I understand these are just kind of broad magnitudes. We're not saying that these exact numbers. But are you making an allowance here for the impact of lockdowns? I mean, is the assumption that you're saying that there will be no further lockdowns, whereas there might have been lockdowns? What's the assumption there?
As the base case, we've just assumed that the lockdowns that are in place now stay in place until the spring, and then that the vaccine gradually allows these to unwind. But it means that the countries that will get the biggest boost from the vaccine will obviously be the ones that have got the tightest lockdown conditions or the lowest levels of GDP. So like the UK falls into that category, Spain as well, where there's really a lot of scope for improvement if they can they can move past the crisis phase of the pandemic.
And well, you say the UK, of course, and this is to throw something else in the mix, but of course, the UK in those 3 months is also going to be going through the sort of the final stage of Brexit. It's actually not going out of the sort of transition period of Brexit, where we were still following all the European rules. You spent quite a lot of time thinking about what's going to happen to the UK next year. Do you think we're going to be able to see the effect of Brexit in the numbers, or is it just going to be crowded out by this big boost from vaccinations and the bounce back of the economy generally as you come out of the pandemic?
Well, I think if there is an impact from Brexit, it's likely to happen just before there's a boost from the pandemic. So you probably would see it in the numbers because it would happen in the first quarter of this year. I don't think it's that likely that there'll be a huge proportion of the population vaccinated by the end of then. I mean, I guess the interesting thing about Brexit is that some of the policies that are in place to deal with COVID are also going to work pretty well for the Brexit shock, because both COVID and Brexit disruption would be a pretty similar supply-side disruption to the economy, something that's hopefully temporary that would eventually go away. And so it calls for the same sort of policy settings. So in the UK, we have a large furlough scheme to protect workers, protect jobs. That would work if there was disruption for Brexit or if there's continued disruption for COVID. So in some ways, it's helpful that those policies are already in place.
When you think about what your sort of base case is for next year, how much does the pace of vaccination affect where the global economy ends up at the end of next year relative to where it might have been?
No, I think the realistic base case is that a portion of the population is vaccinated in advanced economies. And because it starts with the vulnerable groups, that reduces fatalities quite substantially and allows people to go start living their lives a bit more normally. I mean, the big unknown is how the people that aren't in the vulnerable groups will behave once the vulnerable people are vaccinated. That could be like the huge upside surprise to activity next year, or it could just be a massive damp squib and everyone just stays inside because they're still scared. It's perfectly possible it goes either way. So I think that it's not a question of the medicine. It's not even a question of kind of the standard economics. It's what are people's behavioral response going to be to this? And to be honest, we just don't know.
I have to say, anecdotally, my sense is that people are dying to go on lots of holidays to the extent that they can and go and restaurants and other things. Now, how long that will last?
I think that's right, isn't it? Because I mean, if you think back to the summer, I mean, people were clamoring to get out, go to restaurants, fly, go home. It's one of the reasons why the economy picked up so fast over that period is that people were willing to do things, even though that risk still existed. So I'm fairly optimistic that there'll be a fairly major boost as vaccines roll out.
Jamie Rush, thank you very much. Thanks for listening to Stephanomics. We'll be back next week with more on all things economic. Remember, you can always find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website, app, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can get a lot of news and analysis from Bloomberg Economics during the week by following @economics on Twitter. This episode was produced by Magnus Henriksen, with special thanks to Olivia Rockman, Richard Freeman, Chang Shu, Bjorn Van Roy, and Jamie Rush. Lucy Meakin is the executive producer of Stephanomics, and the head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Lee.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Success. It's discipline. It's teamwork. It's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. And it's why Stifel is one of the fastest growing global wealth management and investment banking firms in the industry. Stifel. It's where success meets success. Start your journey at stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.